Now on to chapter 4, We Agnostics. Now this is a chapter that is addressed to agnostics and atheists. An agnostic is a person who doesn't know whether there's a God or not. An atheist is a person who knows there is no God. I am an agnostic. I was raised by agnostics who were raised by agnostics. I'm a third generation agnostic. I don't think I'll ever believe in a God, but I don't disbelieve. I just don't know, and I know I never will know. This program has not been a problem for me because it is open and inclusive. Now, those of you who are religious may wonder why this chapter should be read, because it's addressed to people who are not religious, who do not have a God. And there are two really important reasons for reading it if you are religious. The first is that you're going to meet people like me, and you're going to have to carry the message to people who don't believe in the God that you believe in. As a matter of fact, chances are good most of the people you meet do not believe in the specific God you believe in. And you're going to have to learn to use language that is inclusive, even though in your external life, in your religious life, you may use a language that you're much more comfortable with, which is related to your particular religion, your particular kind of faith. So the first reason to read this is to know what the arguments are for someone who doesn't have your faith. And that's an important thing, because in step 12, one of your obligation is to carry the message to people who still suffer. And I'm a person people like me still suffer, and you have to carry the message to me, and you have to learn how to do it. The second reason is a very practical one. If you haven't achieved a freedom from food, then clearly your faith is not working for you. And this chapter provides an answer for why your faith is not working for you. There's one page which is addressed to everyone. Towards the end, I'll keep you in suspense. By the way, it is true that I am sucking and chewing something. That's because I have a cough, and I do not want to burden any of you and the people on this tape with that cough. So I am sucking something, but I will watch my eating throughout the day, I can assure you. And believe me, this is not something that's going to awaken cravings in me. I mean, there's some sugar in it, but believe me, the taste is certainly not designed to make me want more. So this chapter has, it actually, towards the end of it, it actually explains why the steps work. And it explains the difference between having faith and living faith, and being sane. And it's really wonderful and very, very powerful. I just realized I did not read to you Dr. Jung's letter. So I'd better read Dr. Jung's letter to you. It's all about faith, so it's apropos to read it now. In 1961, January, Bill wrote to Carl Jung to thank him for the contribution that Carl Jung had made to Alcoholics Anonymous. Remember, I told you about Roland. And he sent him a copy of the big book, and Dr. Jung responded. And in the pictures that I was sending around, that picture, the letter is actually was framed by Lois very amateurishly, and it's up in this stepping stones, it's called, this house that Bill and Lois lived in on the second floor. So Dr. Jung says, and this is found in a wonderful book published by AA called The Language of the Heart. And it's a book that contains all of Bill's essays that were contained in the AA magazine called Grapevine, which is the equivalent of our lifeline. Dear Mr. W., your letter has been very welcome indeed. I had no news from Roland H. anymore, and often wondered what had been his fate. Our conversation, which he has adequately reported to you, had an aspect of which he did not know. Now, so first of all, Carl Jung is saying this is true. The conversation that you quoted me, in which you quoted me, is accurate. I just read an article that questions that. Said towards the end of his life, Jung was kind of vague in his thinking, and his secretary wrote all of his letters for him, but I don't care. This letter comes from Carl Jung. It's signed by Carl Jung. I'm going to take it. The reason that I could not tell him everything was that those days I had to be exceedingly careful of what I said. I had found out that I was misunderstood in every possible way. Thus, I was very careful when I talked to Roland H. But what I really thought about was the result of many experiences with men of his kind. His craving for alcohol was the equivalent, on a low level, of the spiritual thirst or hunger of our being for wholeness, expressed in medieval language, the union with God. So his craving for alcohol, and this is really the obsession, the whatever alcohol brings to the alcoholic, whatever food brings to us, that sense of ease and comfort, is a low-level expression of our spiritual hunger for wholeness. We feel apart. We don't feel whole. He says, how could one formulate such an insight in the language that is not misunderstood in our days? The next paragraphs are really interesting. Hard. Took me a long time to understand them. The only right and legitimate way to such an experience, the experience of spiritual wholeness, is that it happens to you in reality. And it can only happen to you when you walk on a path which leads you to higher understanding. So the only way you're going to get a spiritual experience is you walk on a path to a higher understanding. And he gives two ways by which that can happen. He says, you might be led to that goal by an act of grace or through a personal and honest contact with friends. So you can be led to that, a higher goal, by contact with friends or by an act of grace. Something just happens to you and you're just sort of opened up. Or through a higher education of the mind beyond the confines, the box of mere rationalism, or through trying to educate your mind beyond going through just logic. I see from your letter that Roland H. has chosen the second way, which was, under the circumstances, obviously the best way. So Roland chose a path that would lead to higher understanding by going beyond mere logic. I am strongly convinced, he says, that the evil principle prevailing in this world leads this unrecognized spiritual need, this unrecognized spiritual need for wholeness, into perdition, hell. And these are words that don't come easily to me, I'll tell you. So that this evil principle, that there's an evil principle that's in this world, and it leads this spiritual hunger for wholeness into hell, which is like the hell of compulsive eating, the hell of alcoholism, the hell of all kinds of things, addictions. If it is not counteracted, so you need a counteracting force to this evil force. And there are two kinds: real religious insight, or the protective wall of human humanity. An ordinary man not protected by an action from above, religious insight, and isolated in society, no common wall of human humanity, cannot resist the power of evil. What does OA, AA, any 12-step group provide us but real religious insight or spiritual insight and the protective wall of human humanity? So we're doubly protected in our goal for a higher understanding and our search for spiritual wholeness. I think that's brilliant. I think it's just, this is what is offered to us, this whole notion that we're both protected by the common wall of humanity and we're given a path that's beyond the confines of mere logic to a higher spiritual understanding. And that's why this program answers our spiritual hunger or thirst for wholeness. Isn't that neat? He says, the use of such words, he calls the devil, arouses so many mistakes one can only keep aloof from them as much as possible. These are the reasons I couldn't give a full and sufficient explanation to Roland H., but I'm risking it with you because I conclude from your very decent and honest letter that you have acquired a point of view above the misleading platitudes, cliches, one usually hears about alcoholism. You see, alcohol in Latin is spiritus, and you use the same word for the highest religious experience, spiritus, as well as the most depraving poison, spiritus. The helpful formula, therefore, is spiritus, spirituality, contra, against, spiritum, spirits. Spirituality against spirits, rather against alcohol. That's a neat letter. Okay, so we agnostics, page 44. Joe and Charlie love to read this first paragraph. I do too. In the preceding chapters, you've learned something of alcoholism. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, that's the obsession of the mind. That's the mental obsession. I want to stop drinking, but I can't. I keep going back to it. Or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, that's the physical craving. I can't stop. Once I start, I can't stop. You are probably alcoholic. Now, AA, Joe and Charlie point out, AA has a pamphlet called 44 Questions to See If You're an Alcoholic. OA has a pamphlet 15 questions or 18 questions, I've forgotten how many questions, to see if you're a compulsive eater. The big book has two questions. Do you have an allergy of the body, or do you have an obsession of the mind? If you have one or the other, you probably have both. And that really is so much simpler to me, and that's one of the reasons I love the big book's approach to the problem, is that it's so simple to explain to a newcomer. The symbol of the hand going to the mouth and the mind saying, I gotta stop, and not being able to stop. Same for the alcoholic, the drinking, I gotta stop, and not being able to stop drinking, or the drug addict, and all of the many excuses that I use to go back are the very simple ways by which you can explain to any compulsive eater, if that person is a compulsive eater, what the miracle you experience is. Because if they have that problem, they know exactly why it's a miracle to say, I can be around ice cream or any binge food and not want it. Because they have the mind that has always given them permission to go back, and they despair, for good reason, of ever being able to get rid of the mind. So I like that. They go on, they talk about atheism and agnosticism. They say, don't worry, half of us were agnostics or atheists. It's not that big a deal. And we'll tell you why in this chapter. On page 45, they set out the problem. Lack of power. That was our dilemma. It's the problem. Lack of power. That's what step one is. Powerlessness. The problem. Step one, we have no power. We're powerless over food. So that's simple. Once we accept that we ourselves are powerless, that we have no control, the big book says, we have to find a power by which we could live. And it had to be a power greater than ourselves. How could it not be? It had to be more powerful than we are, because we are powerless. As Bill says, there had been no more power in Ebby than there was in me at that moment, and that was none at all. And yet he had a miracle, and I didn't. So clearly he found a power that was greater and more powerful than he was. The big book says obviously it had to be a power greater than ourselves. That's the second shortest sentence in the big book. But where and how were we to find this power? Where is described in this chapter? How is described in the rest of the book? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. Not which will help you solve your problem, but which will solve your problem. I mean, I'm not proud one way or the other of the fact that I have recovered and that I've been abstinent for X number of years, because it has nothing to do with me. If I were left to my own devices, I would not have been abstinent. If I were left to my own devices, I would weigh 400 or 500 pounds. It's a power that all I did was follow instructions and got a power, which is not my power. How could it be my power? If it were my power, I'd be eating. I'm powerless. So I have found a power greater than myself, which has solved my problem and continues to solve it on a day-to-day, minute-to-minute basis. And they talk about agnostics, and they say, oh, look at the agnostic, and we see religions, and we have all kinds of doubts because religions war with each other, and it's all everyone's skeptical. And they say on page 46, much to our relief, we discovered we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect to create a contact with him. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, the spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, and I suppose it's possible, that's all, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps, the rest of the steps. We found God doesn't make too hard terms with those who seek him. To us, the realm of spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. It is open, we believe, to all men. And here's, again, remember I told you that I showed you the paragraphs addressed to women and to young people? Here's a chapter addressed to people like me who can't stand any of the religious terms that are found in this book, as open and inclusive as they try to be. Page 47, when therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. This applies too to other spiritual expressions which you find in this book. Don't let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you, stop you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. At the start, this was all we needed to commence spiritual growth, to effect our first conscious relation with God as we understood. So, we need to ask ourselves, they say in that same, in the next paragraph, but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? Am I willing to believe? Well, you know, was I willing when I started this program? I saw recovery in other people. They told me that they used to be like me, and they described themselves in ways that made it very clear that they were like me, but they weren't like me now. They clearly were different. One, they had reached a healthy body weight, but more important than reaching a healthy body weight, they were able to describe how they were completely insured against going back and having another bite, how they didn't want what I knew I couldn't stop from going to. And that was a miracle to me. And they told me they did it by having a spiritual awakening. And they told me they got that spiritual awakening by following the 12 steps of Overeaters Anonymous. Well, was I willing to believe that I could find some kind of spiritual power by using doing the 12 steps? What did I have to lose? Was I willing? Sure, I was willing. What did I have to lose except my obsession? What did I have to lose except the pounds? Nothing. How many diets had I tried in which I should have had much less faith? Because every diet I ever tried gave me back the food and sent me back to the misery that I used to be in. Why shouldn't I try something that seemed to do something different? Try it. It's an old Jewish joke about an actor who suddenly collapses in the middle of a play, and for a while people think it's it's part of the play, but the curtain is drawn and the manager comes out and says, is there a doctor in the house? And the doctor stands up and goes backstage, and then the doctor comes out and says, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry to inform you the actor has died. Give him some chicken soup, says someone from the audience. The actor is dead, and the play, give him some chicken soup. And the doctor says, the actor is dead. Can't hurt, you know. And that's how I sort of look at this program. It can't hurt. I mean, try it. You know, what are you going to lose? They now, on page 48, start with a series of arguments to the agnostic or the atheist. And I used to read this and laugh. I've studied a lot of philosophy. I've studied logic. I know a lot about arguments for and against the existence of God. A lot about them, really. I've studied a lot about them. And I used to laugh at this until I started to really, really read the big book. And I realized that every other chapter had some greatness in it. Maybe this chapter had something in it too. So I start to analyze the arguments. And I have been able to understand the arguments. I don't think they're expressed quite the way I'm going to express them, but these are the arguments that they make. First one starts on page 48 and goes on to the middle of page 51. And this argument is addressed to a scientific mind. A scientific mind, the scientific method is based on this very clear concept. You come up with an hypothesis, an idea, and you test it. And you test it in all kinds of ways. And if that test works out, the hypothesis, the idea, is worth believing in. We have never seen molecules. We have never seen atoms. We probably never will, because it's what we're composed of. But we believe they exist, at least most of us do. And we believe that electricity consists of the motion of molecules along conductors in certain ways. Go back to the 15th century, the 17th century, even the 18th century, the beginning of the 18th century, and the electric light switch would have been magic. People would not have understood it or accepted that it existed on physical principles. Certainly in the 1500s, it would have been magic. And yet we accept it as commonplace because we accept the theories that work, the theory of electricity, the theory of atomic motion, all kinds of scientific theories. Even if we haven't studied them, we may not know them, but we certainly accept the science behind which they do. It's not as if God turns on these lights in any way, or that there's a magician who somehow created these lights. They're based on sound scientific principles, which we cannot prove. But we believe in them because they're based on theories. And we've had all kinds of theories over the years which have changed because the tests for those theories have proven them not to be quite accurate. I'll get into that in a few minutes. So they say, here's our theory. We work these steps and they give us a spiritual awakening which relieves us of our mental obsession. And it works. Try it. That's not a bad argument, you know. I mean, when you come to think of it, if a theory works, why shouldn't I try it? If I have a scientific mind, why shouldn't I try a theory that works? And that's basically page 48 to page 51. Page 50, for instance, they talk about the personal stories. And they say right in the middle, on one proposition, all kinds of people have found their God in all kinds of different ways. They say on one proposition, these men and women are strikingly agreed. Every one of them has gained access to and believes in a power greater than himself. That's the theory. This theory has in each case accomplished the miraculous, the humanly impossible. That's the fact. These are people who have conquered food, or in whom food has been conquered. And they all say they did it using certain spiritual principles, spiritual ideas. You get honest with yourself, you get honest with another human being, you make amends for the wrongs you've done. You help others with a hope of reward or prestige, and you pray to whatever God you believe in for guidance. Here are thousands of men and women, worldly indeed. They flatly declare, this is since they've come to believe in a power greater than themselves, to take a certain attitude toward that power, to do certain simple things, the steps, there's been a revolutionary change in their way of living and thinking. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of the total failure of their human resources, they found that a new power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction flowed into them. This happened soon after they wholeheartedly met a few simple requirements, the steps. Once confused and baffled by the seeming futility of existence, they show the underlying reasons why they were making heavy going of life. Leaving aside the drink question, they tell why living was so unsatisfactory. They show how the change came over them. When many hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important fact of their lives, they present a powerful reason why one should have faith. And that's true. That's what got me. I was willing to do anything, anything, to get out of the horrible hell that I realized I was living in. And once it was made clear to me that that hell was something I could never get out on my own, I turned to anything that would help me. And that was the steps. That was what this program offered me, and that's what I clung to. That's the first argument. A theory that's grounded in fact is worth trying and worth believing in. That's clear. It's a very sound scientific principle, a very sound argument. The next argument is similar, a little different. The only progress that has ever been made in human existence comes from people willing to look outside the box. That's clear too. I mean, I studied Aristotle, the great Greek philosopher. He had a mind that was bigger than any mind I've ever encountered, except another philosopher named Kant, and probably Albert Einstein, but I don't understand Einstein. I have some understanding of Aristotle and Kant. Aristotle, 2,500 years ago, or however long ago he lived, was as brilliant, more brilliant than almost anyone in the world is today. And yet he believed that the stars went around the earth. He believed in all kinds of things that we do not believe in now. The progress in thought came when people decided to try something different. They used the examples of Galileo and Copernicus were people who were willing to think. Well, for years, as ship navigation was just confined to small areas, the movement of the stars. Based on the theory that the stars went around the earth and that the sun went around the earth, worked. But as people began to go farther in their shipping, the stars moved. And they weren't able to be used in this with the same accuracy. And Galileo and Copernicus came up with a theory. Maybe the earth is revolving around the sun and is rotating on its axis, and that then explains why the stars move in the way they do, in the way that the previous theory didn't do it. Now, Galileo was almost put to death for believing that, because it was against the common understanding of his time. But those were theories that they said were outside the box. There are all kinds of ideas about whether Columbus was really the only person to believe that the Earth was round. But here's a guy, at least, who is, from a legendary point of view, is the idea everyone else thought, you get to a certain point and you fall over the edge of the Earth. It was flat. And he was willing to believe that the Earth was round and that he could get to India by going in the opposite direction from where India was. Just go around the world. Now, he didn't get to India. But he certainly did prove to many people that the Earth was round, that you didn't at least fall off the edge and fall beside the turtle, the four turtles that were holding up, they're standing on the elephant that held up the flat Earth. A willingness to go beyond the box. Roger Bannister and John Landy were runners who were living in a world in which people said you could never beat the 4-minute mile. No one ever beat the 4-minute mile. They thought they could. They trained. They beat the 4-minute mile. Bannister was 3:58 and Landy was 3:59. No one who runs competitively doesn't beat the 4-minute mile. They all beat the 4-minute mile because these people were able to break the barrier. Just before the Wright brothers flew their plane in Kitty Hawk, Louisiana, the New York Times evidently had a huge symposium of physicists and mathematicians who all came to the conclusion that it was impossible to build a heavier-than-air flying machine, that you would never be able to do it. 2 months, 3 months later, two bicycle mechanics created a heavier-than-air flying machine and flew it for 67 seconds or whatever it was. A willingness to try something that's not been tried before, a willingness to go outside of your traditions, outside of your normal belief system, is the only way you might be able to achieve change in your life. That's a very powerful argument. It appeals to the adventurous scientist and logician in me. And they say on page 52, we have to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be a real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. When we saw others solve their problems by simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas did not work. The God idea did. Now, if they didn't have that paragraph in there saying, forget the word God, we're using these words, you can use whatever words you want, I would not have read much farther. But it's simple. We in OA, we in AA, we in all the 12-step groups have an idea. You work these steps, you'll find some kind of a higher power that will solve your problem. It seems to be a solution that we have, and you have not found any solution for yourself. Try something out of the box. That's a good argument. The next argument, though, is the most powerful, because it shows me to be the hypocrite that I am. And it starts on the bottom page 52, and it goes on for a while. Basically, it's not working for you. Self-sufficiency doesn't work for you. You might think you're self-sufficient, but you're not. You're eating. You're drinking. You try to be logical. It's not working for you. Logic isn't working for you. Logic would tell you you shouldn't go back to eating. Your mind should be able to, if you're logical, should be able to say to you, don't have that first bite. Don't have that first drink. Don't have the first drug use. Don't gamble again. But it doesn't work. Your rationality is not working. And then on page 53, they say, in the second last paragraph there, arrived at this point, we're squarely confronted with the question of faith. We couldn't duck the issue. Some of us had already walked far over the bridge of reason toward the desired shore of faith. That's a wonderful image, that there's a bridge there. And reason brings us so far. Reason tells us we should try things that, if nothing else works, we should try a theory that has been tested and seems to work. Those are the logical things. The outlines and the promise of the new land had brought luster, high light polish to tired eyes and fresh courage to flagging spirits. friendly hands that stretched out a welcome. We were grateful that reason had brought us so far, but somehow we couldn't quite step ashore. Perhaps we'd been leaning too heavily on reason that last mile, and we did not like to lose our support. We're arrived at a certain point where there is a gap between the bridge of reason, the end of the bridge of reason, and the shore of faith. And that's a gap that has been described by the great philosopher Søren Kierkegaard, Danish philosopher in the early 1900s, or late 1800s, early 1900s, as requiring a leap of faith. And that leap of faith is just flying out into the unknown. And why do we do that? I mean, we have to do that. Clearly, that's where we are. We have to do that. How do we take that leap? Well, the big book says, right at the bottom, let's think a little bit more closely. Without knowing, bottom page 53, had we not been brought to where we stood by a certain kind of faith? For did we not believe in our own reasoning, page 54? Did we not have confidence in our ability to think? What was that but a sort of faith? And that's true. How do I prove that logic is right? I can't. Because the only way to prove something is to use logical reasoning. You can't use logical reasoning to prove logic. You have to assume logic to prove, to start with logical reasoning. And that's true. And some philosophers have created all kinds of philosophical systems based on different forms of logic, which are contrary to what we know is logic. You assume logic, so I believe in something, even though I can't prove it. Now, it happens to be logic and not God, but I believe in something and I can't prove it. And then they go on and they begin to put the screws on very tightly. Yes, we'd been faithful, abjectly, hopelessly faithful to God of reason. So in one way or another, we discovered that faith had been involved all the time. We found, too, we had been worshippers. What a state of mental goose flesh that used to bring on. Had we not variously, in various different ways, worshipped people, sentiment, things, money, and ourselves, and then with a better motive, had we not worshipfully beheld the sunset, the sea, or a flower? Who of us had not loved something or somebody? How much did those feelings, these loves, these worships, have to do with pure reasoning? Little or nothing, we saw at last. Were not these things the tissue out of which our lives were constructed? Did not these feelings, after all, determine the course of our existence? It was impossible to say we had no capacity for faith or love or worship. In one form or other, we've been living by faith and little else. When my daughter was first born in this very hospital, I held her 1 minute after she was born. And I don't know if I said it or just thought it, but I know the thought came to my mind. I might have said it, I'd die for you. And I would have. And I'd still do it, although over the years, in her teenage years, there were moments I might have regretted that decision. But I mean, she's an incredibly wonderful and lovely person, and we went through some difficult times, and I only joke about that. I have always loved her tremendously. But what reason led me to the notion that I would die for my daughter, or that I would die for my wife, or I'd die for my other daughter? My second daughter was born in this hospital as well. What? There's no reason. When my daughter was 1 minute old, I was of more value to the human race than she was. You know, I was doing nice and good things, and there was every reason to believe that, at least for the next 20 years, I would continue to be more valuable to the human race than she would be. So what got me to the point where I would say I would die for you? And you know, I mean, I happen to be an incredible admirer, or not incredible, I happen to be a great admirer of Mahatma Gandhi, who I think was just an incredible person. And I've thought to myself, you know, if Mahatma Gandhi suddenly appeared in the birthing room of this hospital and I'm holding my daughter, and Mahatma Gandhi said, I've just been sent back on a mission to save the world, and I know I can do it, and I would believe that Gandhi could do it, but it requires the sacrifice of your daughter, I would have said, go to hell, Mahatma. You know, my daughter's living. What reason would have brought me to that? What reason is there in my worship of Johann Sebastian Bach, the great composer? There's no reason in there. When I listen to his music, I am transported. What logic gets me transported? Logic doesn't get me transported. I worship that. I love those things. And that love is more powerful than any logic in the world is. So the big book says, so you need to have a leap of faith to go from the bridge of reason to the shore of faith? Haven't you already taken that leap already? Don't you already believe in things? And my first sponsor said to me, what do you believe in? What is more important than you are? Do you believe in anything that you can't justify? Is there anything that you would be willing to die for? And I said yes, because that was the truth. I mean, I don't know. I know I die for my daughter and my wife. I know that would be like an automatic reflex. I don't know if I die for everyone. I don't know if I have the courage to die in ways that I think I could die for. You know, I'd like to think I'd die for all kinds of principled ways, but who knows what would happen in the pinch. But theoretically, I made a list of what was more important than I am. Truth, love, justice, and beauty. Those are concepts. They're not a god in the sense of what many people would call God in the outside world. But they're things I believe in, and they're things that I believe are more important than I am. And I said that to my sponsor. He said, call it God. I said, well, it's not God. God means, you know, some kind of being that exists both in another world and this world in some way. Call it God, he said. What's your problem? In OA, in the 12-Step Fellowship, it means anything you want. And some people here will remember Barb, I just blanked her name for a second, who was the first person I talked to in OA. She was on the phone list. She's passed away. And she had a religion, a very, very deep religion, which was absolutely contrary to everything I believed in. And she and I had wonderful conversations about God because she didn't care what my God was like and I didn't care what her God was like. What we saw in each other, for me it was more passing because I was relapsing in and out of the time before she died, but when I had those moments of recovery, those weeks or months of recovery, and we talked about God, we were so happy for each other's spiritual truths. And we had no interest in her trying to impose her spiritual truths on me or my trying to impose my spiritual truths on her. We were just able to discuss God in this program. And that's what my sponsor said. He said, call it good orderly direction. That made sense to me. People who are more religious talk about getting direction from God in the form of their spiritual scriptures or their spiritual leaders from their surroundings. In some way they get some direction that tells them where they should be going. In a sense, God is pushing them from the behind in the shape of what they believe in. And for me, God is like a compass direction. It's like true north. Truth, love, justice, and beauty. All around, there's a compass that is giving me 359 other directions, which I call Lori's way. And then there's the way of truth, love, justice, and beauty. True north. And for me, that is my direction. So instead of a more religious kind of God pushing you from behind, I have a God that pulls me from in front. But either way, I'm getting directions. And so I get direction from my God. And my God is completely conceptual and abstract. But if I live a life according to truth, love, justice, and beauty, rather than a life according to my concepts of what should be happening in this world, I'm living a spiritual path. So that's my answer. And that's the answer that my sponsor gave me. And I am led to that because I believe in those things. They are my passion. They are what I believe in, and I cannot justify them. And so I have taken that leap of faith already without even thinking about it. I am a hypocrite. I say, oh, I can't believe in God because no one should believe in something that he or she can't see or prove or anything like that. And yet I believe in all kinds of things I can't see or prove. Truth, love, justice, and beauty. So that's the argument to the agnostic and the atheist. You do believe in something. And what's working for what you think works isn't working for you. And you should try something different. Very simple arguments.